Hi, Marco Werman here. We're all on deadline at The World. Our spring fundraiser has just 1 week left, so you only have a limited time for your contribution to The World to be matched by an anonymous donor. In order to take full advantage of that match, we need to raise $13,000 before May 1st. Fact-based journalism with a global perspective is crucial during these uncertain times. You can make our reporting available to millions of people with a tax-deductible gift to The World today. When you give today, your contribution will be doubled by an anonymous donor. That means $75 of support actually becomes $150. The World is freely available to anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to report stories from around the world with nuance, context, and with voices of the people affected. Today, we ask your support of that goal. Help keep access to The World free for everyone. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute today, while your gift will have twice the impact. We still need to raise $13,000 to take full advantage of an anonymous donor's match. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. The elderly at risk. In Canada, nursing homes have seen a shocking number of deaths from COVID-19.
The minute, we dealt with one person's death, then there was somebody else down the hall who looked like they were really, really close.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today on The World, social media is able to blast out information. In a pandemic, it's a blessing and a curse.
The blessing is that it's easy to spread information quickly, and the curse is it's very hard to filter out what is accurate and what is not.
And
I'm Dr. Susie Wiles, and I've got a message for everyone who's meeting their neighbors down the bottom of the driveway. Don't.
She's part advice columnist, part gentle nudger, a microbiologist in New Zealand, her country's go-to source on all things coronavirus. Those stories and more today here on The World. We are closing in on 3 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus worldwide and around 200,000 fatalities. What started with news at the beginning of the year of a health crisis developing in China grew into a pandemic that has touched almost every country on Earth. The U.S. has become the hardest hit. Scientists are trying to figure out when the coronavirus first appeared in the U.S. It's possible, just possible, that the virus was in Las Vegas back in January, much earlier than we thought, at a huge convention for techies.
This is not just the place where the world's best tech gets unveiled. It's where visionary ideas come to life.
About 170,000 people showed up at the Consumer Electronics Show, better known as CES. Some got really sick. Journalists with APM reports have been looking into whether the coronavirus might have been there. Sasha Aslanian has our story.
Michael Weber works for an energy company in Paris. He attended CES with his boss and remembers it was jam-packed.
There's a lot of handshaking. There's a lot of talking to people, a lot of exchanges of cards. There are dinners and breakfasts and meals. It's just a lot of people from different places sharing the same airspace and being in very close proximity to each other.
A number of those people sharing airspace came from China, including more than 100 from the city of Wuhan, where the coronavirus was quickly spreading. Lots of people came from other tech hubs, too, like Silicon Valley. Nazar Youssef's an entrepreneur from the Bay Area. The first day, he remembers meeting a guy who looked under the weather.
He's like, yeah, I probably shouldn't be here. And he was hacking and coughing while we were talking. And the conference was very loud, so we had to kind of get close to hear each other. And so it did cross my mind that, yeah, this is probably not a great idea. I'm probably going to get sick, but it's not a big deal. It's probably just a cold.
A couple days later, Youssef was walking through a section of Chinese exhibitors when something caught his attention.
There's a lot of people coughing here.
Youssef wasn't tracking the news out of China, but U.S. health authorities were. On the second day of CES, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention alerted healthcare workers to keep an eye out for potential cases of the mysterious virus in the U.S., particularly in patients who'd visited Wuhan and had unexplained severe respiratory symptoms. On the last day of the conference, Nazar Youssef thought he caught a bad case of the flu. He was stuck in his Las Vegas hotel room for days.
One time I remember waking up and feeling like I can't get out of bed. Like, I just can't. I can't get my body to function to get out of this bed. This is a problem.
As the conference ended, tens of thousands of people boarded planes home. Michael Weber tweeted that the Las Vegas airport sounded like an infirmary.
And there were so many people hacking and coughing and sneezing. I put out a public tweet thinking, okay, we're going to be sick.
It turns out that Weber was right. Dozens of people started tweeting about what some called the CES flu. They complained that it had them laid up for days with fever, aches and pains, and a dry cough that wouldn't go away. By the time Weber got home to Paris, he was also sick. So was his boss, who'd been at CES with him.
We were sick for like 5 days, and my wife and son, who live with me in Paris, they also got sick. So whatever we had really knocked us flat, and it was a different kind of sickness.
Weber couldn't get a COVID-19 test in Paris. Neither could Nazar Youssef in California. The CDC didn't test the first person in the U.S. until January 18th, more than a week after CES ended. And at first, the only people being tested were those who traveled to China. By April, the only way for Weber and Youssef to check if they'd had COVID-19 was through an antibody test, which detects whether someone's ever been infected. Youssef hasn't gotten his results yet, but Weber, who's now living in Texas, did. The results indicate he had COVID-19. His doctor called him Monday with the news.
He said, congratulations. It's kind of funny, but it does feel like a congratulatory thing because now it offers some peace of mind and lowers my sense of risk for going about society and that kind of thing. And it also explains the mystery of this heinous virus I had in January.
Weber is satisfied, despite questions about the reliability of antibody tests. Gathering more evidence through testing is key to understanding how the virus has been spreading in the U.S. and where and when it first set in. More testing might also help explain something that's been a big mystery.
Why on earth is Santa Clara Valley the hotspot in the Bay Area? That's kind of bizarre.
Peter Chin Hong is an infectious disease expert at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine.
You would think it would be San Francisco because there's tons of people going into SFO, whatever, you know, and a lot of Chinese population.
Santa Clara County is south of San Francisco and includes part of Silicon Valley. More than 150 companies from the county had exhibits at CES. This week, health authorities there reported that the first death from COVID-19 occurred on February 6th. That means the virus was likely circulating in the county weeks earlier than previously thought. Chin Hong is intrigued by the possibility that there's a connection to CES.
And then now when you say, well, maybe a bunch of people went to that conference, and if it was around the same time, then I think that could be ecologic evidence that there was a link to something there earlier when people weren't even paying attention.
No one can say with certainty if the coronavirus was at CES, and its organizers say they haven't been contacted by officials asking whether anyone who attended the conference was exposed to the virus. But if one were to dream up an ideal way to hasten the global spread of a disease, it might look a lot like CES. For The World, I'm Sasha Aslanian.
Our story had reporting from Angela Caputo and Will Kraft. We've all heard the grim reality of COVID-19, how it's especially cruel on older people, like people in nursing homes. Canada's top public health official said last week that half of all the COVID-19 deaths in Canada were in long-term care facilities. Anita Elash in Toronto reports.
Sarah Gardner has seen a lot of people die. She's been a registered nurse for more than 30 years. But nothing prepared her for the weekend when coronavirus started taking the lives of residents at the Pinecrest Nursing Home in tiny Bob Cajun, Ontario.
There was so much confusion. There was so much stuff everywhere. It felt like a war zone.
By the end of that first weekend, 10 people were dead, and it got worse.
The minute, you know, we dealt with one person's death, then there was somebody else down the hall who looked like they were really, really close, and we better get on the phone and make sure that the family's aware that this is probably quite imminent. And do we have the right medication? I got to call the doc and get them some morphine. You know, there was just no time. It just kept coming and coming and coming.
In about 2 weeks' time, 29 residents and one volunteer caregiver were gone. That's nearly half the people who lived at Pinecrest.
Because there's just been so much loss. And everything just feels very different.
The cluster of COVID-19 deaths at Pinecrest remains one of the biggest outbreaks in Canada so far. It's exposed the stark conditions that many nursing home residents and staff live and work in, even in the best of times.
This is a sector in our society that has been neglected for years, if not decades.
Dr. Nathan Stahl is a geriatrician at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Toronto.
It's sort of a perfect storm for catastrophe, really.
Stahl says most governments in Canada and around the world were slow to recognize the risks at nursing homes. The focus was on hospitals, intensive care beds, and equipment shortages. But in Canada, long-term care facilities for the elderly have been starved of funding. Basic nursing home care is paid for by each province. As the population ages, demand for services has increased, but the money hasn't.
The physical infrastructure of these homes are outdated. They're chronically understaffed, and the workers who have worked there have traditionally been underpaid, employed part-time without sick benefits. There is a lack of access to expertise for things like infection control practice.
Pinecrest is one of those outdated, chronically short-staffed nursing homes. It has only a few private rooms. Most of the others sleep up to four people each. Sarah Gardner says that made it impossible to isolate sick patients when the coronavirus hit.
In four bedrooms, if you'd have a sick resident, all you really could do was pull the curtain around and try to manage them as best you could in that small, very small space and hope not to contaminate the other residents in the room.
Things got even more complicated when many staff members got sick too.
It's unmanageable to manage 30 people, the majority of whom have cognitive issues, right? When you're understaffed like that, how do you make sure they wash their hands? How do you make sure that they're clean?
Canadian officials are promising hundreds of millions of dollars for more testing, cleaning, and staff at nursing homes. In Ontario, Premier Doug Ford temporarily banned nursing home staff from working in more than one facility.
We're putting an iron ring of protection around our seniors, especially those in long-term care and retirement homes.
Canada's government is topping up wages for workers who've had to give up multiple part-time jobs so they can comply with the new rules. Gardner says she hopes those rules will become permanent. In the meantime, residents at Pinecrest are mourning their housemates, but in isolation. Families are still not allowed to visit.
I don't know what the long-term effect of that will be for them. I can only hope for the best. But as my mother always told me, plan for the worst, right? So I don't know. I don't know if Pinecrest will be okay. I don't know if those residents will be okay. I don't even know if I'll be okay.
Hundreds of nurses and personal care workers have contracted the virus, and many nursing homes are still desperately understaffed. The Canadian government says it's sending in military personnel to help out. For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
It's become the thing to do. One of the few refreshing parts about living in a pandemic, we're remembering to thank people, not just nurses and doctors, grocery store workers, cashiers in drugstores, and the folks who deliver our food and packages.
Livrer ce dont les gens ont besoin est important. Aujourd'hui, plus que jamais.
In France, Amazon put out this commercial thanking its workers and reminding people that there's never been a more important time to send deliveries to those in need. The company also says it will do everything it can to protect its employees from the coronavirus. But some in France are not buying it. The French union, which represents Amazon warehouse workers, sued the company, arguing that Amazon workers were not being properly protected. Stéphane Enjaron is a union spokesman. We had him on the show yesterday. He said Amazon would not budge in negotiations.
They didn't want to bargain. They didn't want to listen. It was always the same answers. It's enough what we are doing.
A French court agreed that Amazon wasn't doing enough to protect the health of its employees. The court ruled that Amazon could only deliver essential goods in France or risk a steep fine. The company argued that it didn't want to be put in the bind of having to sort out what is essential versus non-essential, so it would shut things down in France, but was also appealing the decision. Today, Amazon lost that appeal. The union celebrated, calling it a victory for the health of workers during this outbreak. Attorney Jonathan Cadeau, who represents several unions, spoke today. He responded to Amazon's claim that the ruling was ambiguous.
Là, aujourd'hui, on ne pourra pas faire ce reproche à la décision, à l'ordonnance de, à l'arrêt de la Cour d'appel.
Cadeau said the court couldn't be more clear about the ruling. Today's updated court order limits Amazon deliveries to food, pet food, health, and computer items. If the e-commerce giant delivers anything beyond this, the fine could be more than $100,000. Amazon also put out a written statement today. It said their fulfillment centers in France and around the world are safe. And the court's decision was about advancing the union agenda. Amazon's statement said even if 0.1% of their shipments are not in compliance, it could cost them more than $1 billion a week. So it will be keeping its fulfillment centers in France closed. You're listening to The World. Hi, this is Marco Werman. We know you value what we do here at The World. I'm asking you to demonstrate that through your financial support. Our spring campaign only has 1 week to go. That's 1 week to get your contribution matched by an anonymous donor. In order to take full advantage of the match, we still need to raise $13,000 before May 1st. During these unprecedented times, our fact-based global coverage is a critical guidepost for listeners and readers. Our coverage is, and has always been, freely available to anyone who wants it. That happens because of listener support. These days more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking for your support today. Every contribution made in support of The World will be matched, but we have to raise $13,000 to take full advantage of this generous match. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link in the podcast notes. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The coronavirus has pretty much brought air travel to a standstill, as you know. So what happens to all those neatly packaged airline meals? You know, the old pasta or chicken decision? Many of those meals are made ahead of time and frozen. In Manchester, England, there's an organization that's putting them to good use. Corin Bell is the director of Open Kitchen MCR. What have you been able to do with these meals, Corin?
Well, we were sent word of a warehouse just near Manchester Airport that had 1.1 million frozen airplane ready meals that were going to go in a bin. So our organization, we're a not-for-profit, and what we do is stop food from going to waste. So we just thought, well, when so many people are hungry, we can't let that happen. So we got in touch with a logistics company who have helped us to get them moved and keep them stored frozen. And slowly but surely, we're going to get them out to vulnerable people and vulnerable families across Manchester.
So individuals and shelters?
Yeah, we're supporting a range of people at the moment, from people who were street homeless and have now been placed in hotels for the duration of the crisis, families in poverty, older people. There's a huge range of people who've been really hit by this crisis.
So are the airlines donating these meals to you, or is it this refrigerated warehouse near the airport that is kind of the middleman?
It was a bit of a middleman. So these particular meals were the property of Thomas Cook Airlines. The company financially has gone under a little while ago. So this kind of made me chuckle. These meals literally and figuratively became frozen assets.
Yeah, indeed.
And then obviously coronavirus hit, and all of a sudden those meals are not an asset that can be sold off. They're a massive liability because they're costing money to store every day. And that's where the urgency came in. We were told that if we didn't get them shifted pretty quickly, they were all going to end up in a bin.
So how many meals have you delivered so far, and how long can you keep the project going?
We've pretty much completely changed our operating model as a result of the pandemic. So before, we used to work with a huge range of food businesses sourcing perfectly edible food that would otherwise go to waste. And then we used that food to do meeting and events catering. And that for-profit work, subsidized work that we did in the community, supporting people who were in need. And then as the coronavirus hit, every avenue we had for generating income collapsed, because you can't run a catering business when people are socially isolating. But food waste went through the roof, and the number of people who needed our help also went through the roof. So we have just been cooking meals ever since. And we started, I think the first week we put out about 2,000 meals, and we're now in week four. This week, by the time we get to Sunday, we will have put out just over 10,000 meals in 1 week. We have absolutely no idea what the future looks like for us. At the moment, we are part funded by Manchester City Council. We're working really closely with them, and we're part funded by donations. We're powered by volunteers. And whether or not this is sustainable in any sort of normal world. I don't know, but you know, the apocalypse happened and the world is upside down, and we're not going to stop cooking while people need us.
Corinne Bell, the director of Open Kitchen MCR, really good to meet you, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
It's scary and destabilizing enough just dealing with this pandemic. Now consider the women and couples who wanted to have a baby. Thousands of them may lose out on that chance. Fertility clinics here in the U.S. have been advised to suspend treatments. In the U.K., authorities have gone further. All fertility clinics have been ordered to shut their doors. Nobody knows when they might open again. From London, The World's Orla Barry has more.
Ever since the lockdown started, there have been jokes about the baby boom in 9 months' time. But not everyone sees the funny side.
It can be difficult. There's been a few posts on social media that I've sort of had to block because I was like, I can't look at this.
This is Anita Bryan. She's been trying for a baby for almost 5 years with her partner, Matt. In February, Bryan, who lives in northeast England, started her first treatment for IVF, and she was a ball of emotions.
It's quite terrifying, but it's also really exciting. It's the excitement and the terror of like, oh my goodness, this is something that we've waited for so long, and now in less than a year we could actually have a baby.
But 3 days into her treatment, Bryan got a text message from her clinic saying the IVF had to be stopped, and the news floored her.
I was devastated because this was the sort of first positive part of our journey, that it wasn't, oh, let's just try him on this drug, let's just see what happens in a year. This was really positive, that something really practical was going to happen. So I was completely devastated.
Bryan understands the practicalities behind the decision, and at 34, knows that time is on her side. For Shan Brindlow, who's 40, the decision to close all fertility clinics in Britain was yet another blow. She's been through two unsuccessful IVF treatments and had just started her third cycle when she got the call. In Britain, women can have a number of free IVF treatments under the National Health Service, but your age and where you live can determine whether you're eligible. And Brindlow, who lives in the south of England, knows her options are limited.
We don't know how many months we're going to have to wait now. And, you know, we hear all these miracle stories about people conceiving well in their 40s, but that's what they are. They are miracles. They don't happen to everybody.
Brindlow says wanting to start a family has dominated her life with her husband Nick for well over a decade.
We naively thought that this would just happen, and it hasn't happened. You know, your evenings are injections. Your hormones are not your own. You can't plan any weekend breaks. You can't plan any holidays. We're now at that point. We have put our life on hold for 12 years for something that might not happen.
32-year-old Kirsty Duncan agrees that wanting a baby can become an all-consuming experience.
It's an incredibly lonely place to be as a couple, because, you know, you've got friends that are announcing pregnancies left, right and centre because you're of a certain age. And you just think, why is it so easy for them and it's not for us?
Duncan, who lives in northwest England, had her treatment postponed last month. She found great support from other women on Instagram, but she says many women and men are struggling, and it doesn't help that some couples are reluctant to talk about their fertility issues.
I mean, I think there's this kind of British uneasiness of talking about something to do with sex, and especially if your sex organs don't work. Oh gosh, well, if they're talking about IVF, that means they must have had sex at some point in their life, and that's too distasteful for us to talk about.
There might be another reason couples keep their fertility problems to themselves. Lots of people, it seems, like dishing out some very unhelpful advice.
There's so many people that I know will just say, you just need to go on holiday, get a dog. I would say that the worst thing is when people say, just relax. That is just because it's like someone, you know, when you're really riled up and someone just says, just calm down. And, you know, it's the opposite.
Staying calm while dealing with fertility issues under lockdown is certainly a challenge. But Anita Bryan says she's facing another hurdle.
My biggest worry is how much chocolate I'm going to eat over the next few months.
Nope, she's not joking. The health service in Britain only funds your IVF treatment if your body mass index is under a certain number. And like most of us, Bryan is trying not to comfort eat her way through the lockdown. For Shan Brindlow, the pandemic has been a reminder of just how little control we have over our lives. She says she's leaving it up to fate to decide whether she'll be a mother someday. And if it's not meant to be, that's okay too.
We've had a lot of time just us two. You know, and I only want kids with him. I don't want them with anyone else. And I know it sounds twee, but, you know, I'm really lucky. I do have the love of my life. Not everyone has that.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
News headlines are just around the corner. You're listening to The World. We all need an escape right now. Many have found a place where there's plenty to do and no time pressure to do it in.
You know, if someone says to you, go to your happy place, it just feels like what you might imagine for a happy place, with lovely beaches and sun shining and trees bursting with fruit.
You can go there too. We'll tell you how, coming up on The World. As the coronavirus spreads, so does misinformation, phony science, false data, unproven medical cures. Here's President Trump last night adding to the misinformation.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that.
Medical professionals, as well as companies that make those products, reacted swiftly, warning people not to ingest disinfectant because that could kill you. Right now, bad information isn't just unhelpful, it's potentially lethal. That's why a couple of Harvard students have launched a global effort to debunk persistent myths. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
The month of March started off pretty normal for Amina Ziad. The 24-year-old Harvard medical student was going to classes, to clinic, then back to the dorm.
COVID-19 was sort of on our radar. We were talking about it a little bit, but, you know, to be quite honest, it wasn't something that I was extremely concerned about at the beginning.
By the second week of March, things started to change.
Here's where we stand right now. The World Health Organization is officially calling this outbreak a global pandemic.
Declared a global pandemic, and now the extreme new measures in the U.S. Large events banned.
Friday, March 13th, we were basically, everybody was leaving in this sort of panicked chaos. We were trying to move out of our dorm.
Ziad got her stuff together and headed over to her parents' place. They live just outside of Boston. Campus became a ghost town, but Ziad and her fellow med students stayed in close touch. How could they not be obsessed with the pandemic, the biggest medical crisis of our time? And as they talked, something became more and more obvious, Ziad says. There is so much misinformation about the coronavirus online.
You know, gargling really hot water with salt will kill the bacteria or kill the virus in your throat before it gets down to your lungs. You know, make sure you drink hot water with like cinnamon and all these sort of like concoctions. I also saw several that were, you know, mix bleach with this and it'll like kill the virus. And those were personally the ones that concerned me the most, because mixing chemicals is never a good idea.
Social media is a powerful thing. Sara Alzobe, another medical student at Harvard, says it's also a blessing and a curse.
The blessing is that it's easy to spread information quickly, and the curse is it's very hard to filter out what is accurate and what is not.
So the two students came up with an idea to put simple, accurate information about COVID-19 on social media. Alzobe and Ziad have roots in the Middle East and North Africa. Alzobe was born in Jordan, and Ziad's family is from Algeria. So they decided to target communities there as well as South Asia with straightforward infographics. They relied on guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization.
Basically, our infographics have information about, you know, what are the main symptoms, and then, you know, what are things that you can do to protect yourself and those around you. And then the last sort of panel that we focused on in our infographics is, you know, what to do if you're experiencing these symptoms.
With the help of translators around the world, they've created social media posts in 20 different languages so far.
Arabic, Kurdish, so in two different dialects, Pashto, and
even native languages in Libya and Algeria, Alzobe says. They send them out on WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And that's where you could say the blessing side of social media kicks in. Family and friends shared them. A blogger in Turkey with 15,000 followers posted them. Local journalists tweeted them out.
it's funny because these infographics have circulated in such a way that, like, my mom just got it in a group chat that she's in.
Azobet says they're hearing back from people all over the world, thanking them for debunking misinformation.
Saying, like, this is what my mom needs to see, and this is what the aunties need to see. And I think that's kind of our goal. I think that's hitting essentially what we had started our project with, hoping to become a source of accurate and concise information.
Changing the minds of stubborn parents, aunties, and uncles. Now, that's an accomplishment. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafori.
Who have you been hanging out with lately? Well, that used to be a casual question. Now it's a loaded one. To beat back the coronavirus, we're supposed to be hanging out with, well, nobody. But that's not how we live. So now we deal in bubbles, as in, who's in your bubble? Susie Wiles is a microbiologist who takes science to the masses in New Zealand, often through online videos.
Kia ora, folks, and welcome to COVID Chat with me, Dr. Susie Wiles, where we talk about the science of COVID-19 and answer all your questions.
Wiles has become a familiar voice in New Zealand media, separating fact from fiction and advising Kiwis on best practices during the pandemic. Susie Wiles, thanks for being with us. Let's start with you. Who's in your bubble right now?
Oh, it's a very small bubble. It's just myself and my husband and our teenage daughter.
Right. So you think bubbles are pretty important. And why, though? I mean, define a bubble and why you think they're crucial.
So here in New Zealand, a bubble is your household, although we do have a little bit of flexibility. So for those who maybe have shared custody of children, they're allowed to form a bigger bubble. And those who maybe have, you know, are living on their own, they can sort of form a bubble with another person living on their own. But yeah, they're extremely important, basically to limit the number of people that we have contact with, so that if somebody in that bubble does have the virus, that it only spreads to the people in that bubble and nobody else.
So I want us to listen to just kind of your tone in one of your online advice chats, 60 Seconds with Susie. You sound a little bit peeved here.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susie Wiles, and I've got a message for everyone who's meeting their neighbours down the bottom of the driveway, even if you're staying 2 meters apart. Don't.
So, Susie, I know this habit really bugs you. Neighbours meeting at the end of the day for a glass of wine in the driveway. Why is that bad, even if you're 6 feet apart?
Because that 6 feet is all about, you know, trying to maintain a minimum distance away from people when you are in contact for a short period of time. So, you know, we are allowed out of our bubbles here in New Zealand to go to the supermarket or to, you know, go for a walk or a cycle. And the idea is that, yes, you will encounter people in those scenarios, but you need to stay away from them and you need to keep that contact short. What people are doing here is sort of taking that, you know, 6 feet as the limit and saying, well, that means I can hang out for an hour or two and chat with people as long as we stay that far apart. And that is really not the point.
But I think about essential workers, people working in hospitals or supermarkets. What are they supposed to do?
So that's a different thing entirely. So the whole point about the rest of us who aren't in those scenarios, so those of us who are not essential workers and are supposed to be in our bubble, the reason we're staying in our bubble is because other people, you know, can't. And so what's really important for keeping our COVID-19 cases down is that everybody follows those rules. So it's, you know, it is impossible for those supermarket workers and everybody to stay 6 feet apart. Mm. What's really important for them is that we minimize the other people that are doing that.
I'm thinking also about families where the parents don't live together and the kids travel between households. That's a difficult one. How should parents navigate that?
We would just say that they would form one big bubble. But what becomes more difficult is with those even bigger blended families where then, you know, there is another partner and more children. And so what we've been asking in those scenarios is that families just think about how they can minimize the size of their bubble. Here in New Zealand, it's for a relatively short period of time because we acted so fast. Obviously, that is much more difficult in other countries that didn't act as fast. And so they're going to likely have to be under these conditions for a lot longer. It's all just, if there was a case in your bubble, how would you minimize its spread to fewer people?
Mm. Well, a lot of the world, as you know, is watching New Zealand really carefully. New Zealand seems determined not just to contain the coronavirus, but completely ridding the country of it. Do you think that's possible?
Absolutely. Provided we all, you know, take this seriously and move through the levels slowly. Because what we've seen in other countries is if you pull off these controls too fast, then you still have cases there and then you see the numbers start to rise exponentially again. What we're doing is trying to move down the levels to the stage where we may still have some cases, but that our contact tracing and isolation will be able to deal with those cases. But eventually we should be able to get it to zero. Of course, we'll still be vulnerable because the virus will be around in the rest of the world. So the long-term question is, how do we deal with that? How do we stop the virus or minimize the virus coming into the country and stop it from taking off again?
Susie Wiles is a microbiologist and has become a go-to voice in New Zealand across all media on what people can do to contain the coronavirus. Susie, great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
What you're about to hear is something you may have seen on social media, someone telling somebody else to speak English.
English is the hard first language, so you need to speak English.
I'm sorry about you.
Well, I'm sorry about you, too.
What?
Get the out of my country.
Disturbing. Are we seeing more of these kinds of confrontations these days, or are there just more people with smartphones to record them and places to post them online? What we do know is that equating English proficiency with patriotism is almost as old as America itself. Last year, the White House got in on the act with a proposal for a new immigration law.
Future immigrants will be required to learn English and to pass a civics exam prior to admission.
This is something that is not just playing out in the United States. Patrick Cox reports from the Netherlands, which has become something of a pioneer in Europe for requiring immigrants to learn the national language, Dutch.
Hasna Boerza is in her 40s, the youngest of seven siblings. In the 1970s, her father left Morocco to find work in Europe. He ended up in the Netherlands.
And then in 77, we all joined him.
The Boerza family moved to a Dutch village. They were the only immigrants there.
Did you learn Dutch by going to school?
Yeah. And I do remember very vividly the moment that I realized that I had learned Dutch very quickly. I was playing with children at kindergarten and that I all of a sudden realized, you know, I speak Dutch, and it went very quickly.
This Dutch-speaking Moroccan family, they might have been called model immigrants if the Dutch government had any kind of model in mind. They were different from the vast majority of immigrants who moved to big cities.
Nothing was done to integrate them in the society.
This is Ricky van Urs, an immigration law specialist at Radboud University in the Dutch city of Nijmegen.
The authorities thought too easily of asking someone to come over to work, stay for 20 years and then go back.
When the authorities realized that families from Morocco and elsewhere weren't going back, they tried to get them to learn Dutch, and when that only partially worked, attitudes hardened. From around September 11th, 2001, a series of anti-immigrant political parties started winning seats in elections. Their leader these days is Geert Wilders. Here's what he says about Moroccan immigrants.
We're asking Moroccan scum in Holland. And once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe.
According to Wilders and his followers, to be truly Dutch, you need to speak the language. That message has gained popularity. The Dutch government now requires people who want long-term work permits to take private Dutch classes and pass a language proficiency exam.
And if they don't pass this exam within a certain period of time, currently that period of time is 3 years, they are fined.
This is law professor Ricky van Urs again. She says the requirements put the Dutch ahead of the game in Europe.
I think the Netherlands can be perceived as sort of a guiding country. The Netherlands is very proud to have taken up that role. And you see that different European countries have copied the Dutch model.
In spite of this, the Dutch government has recognized that its system is broken. Immigrants don't learn Dutch, the government doesn't offer proper support, and there's no end in sight to right-wing politicians calling immigrants scum. The country faces a general election next year, and everyone expects immigrants and language to be a major issue. Jan Paternotte is a member of parliament representing one of the parties in the ruling coalition.
I'm interested in how this is going to play out in an election year, because it's very easy to say the people who come here, we're not going to make their life any easier, we're just going to make it harder. So there's a signal to everyone else, don't come to the Netherlands.
Paternotte is among those trying to change the system, so that immigrants feel incentivized rather than forced to learn Dutch. More like the way Moroccan kid Hasna Boerza learned her Dutch back in the 1980s in a village school.
One of the Dutch values used to be, or at least that's something that they were very proud of, was the tolerance.
Tolerance of other cultures, languages and ideas.
And that's, it's nearly lost.
Boerse now writes books in Dutch that call on her fellow citizens to rediscover that tolerance. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox, Amsterdam.
We're all finding ways to cope. Cooking, binge-watching, I've turned into a mad jigsaw puzzler. And then there's the explosion of video gaming. One game in particular caught the attention of our tech correspondent, Lydia Manalidou. It's giving people an escape to try things mostly unimaginable in real life.
Right as Nintendo was gearing up to release Animal Crossing last month, John Walker was getting ready to hunker down in his home in Bristol, Southwest England, because of the coronavirus. Walker has a wife and a 5-year-old. It was a stressful time. He wasn't planning on getting Animal Crossing, but he writes about video games for a living. So when the game did come out, he started reading people's reviews.
And honestly, I just started crying. The reviews were talking about this wonderful safe place, a beautiful island where you could create and just have fun.
In the game, you, the player, are a human living among friendly and really adorable animal neighbors. The objective is to create the island of your dreams and to take care of it. You pull out weeds, plant flowers, and water them.
You can chop trees and get wood and build buildings.
Including your dream house, which you can decorate any way you like. You can sell things for money in the game or use the resources you collect to build things, furniture, soccer fields, playgrounds.
If you have friends playing the game, you can visit their islands and interact, go dig up their flowers. And just generally have a sort of this bucolic, relaxing time where there's plenty to do, but there's no pressure to rush with it.
In this world, there are no lockdowns, no travel restrictions, and no rules about what you can and can't do outside.
Things that we used to do in the real world, and now we are kind of translating that to Animal Crossing.
Alexander Hess is in Santiago, the capital of Chile. He actually played the first version of Animal Crossing, which came out in the early 2000s. He was a young kid at the time.
My mom got me Animal Crossing because animal is written the same in English and in Spanish, so animal. And she said, a game with animals, that's cute.
Hess loved the game as a child, and he loves the new version as an adult. His girlfriend, who lives with him, plays too. Before the coronavirus, the two of them would take each other out on dates all the time. Now they plan those outings through the game.
I basically take a little piece of my island and I create a sweet little spot. I put some tiki torch and a bench, music playing, and basically a picnic basket.
This game is also helping keep romance alive for couples who are apart and can't see each other. Brianna Uscali lives in Florida with her two kids. Her husband is in South Korea. He's in the Air Force. She loves waking up to gifts from him in the game.
Little like clothing items, it might sound silly, that are in the game that he knows that I would like. So like I woke up today and there was two things in my mailbox from him. And one of them was a skirt. So I still have it on in the game right now.
These types of connections and interactions are a healthy distraction for people like Ness Celeste, who lives in the Philippines. The situation there has been tense. Officials have threatened to use violence to enforce lockdown orders and to declare martial law. This worries Celeste, so she likes escaping to a virtual world.
Well, actually, every morning I meet with my friend in their island to get some coffee. Like, she put in a Starbucks there, so meet there every morning and just chat.
Across the South China Sea in neighboring Hong Kong, the game's being used for escapism and activism. Since the pro-democracy movement picked up steam last summer, there's been chaos and a major crackdown from China. Ping, who wanted us to only use his first name, lives in Hong Kong. He says activists have been using Animal Crossing to criticize the government more freely.
Without being harassed, without being a fear of what you express may get you into trouble.
Just a few days ago, Joshua Wong, a high-profile activist, shared a screenshot of a flag he made on his island that said, "Free Hong Kong, revolution now." There are other examples of this too, and it might explain why China has reportedly banned sales of the game. So there are the Animal Crossing protests, and then there are the parties. John Scheel and Ashley Price Bell are elementary school teachers in Melbourne, Australia. They were supposed to get married a couple weeks ago, but then coronavirus happened.
Be cancelled, and we're pretty distraught and very depressed yeah. for a while.
But the wedding did go on, not in Australia, but on a virtual island in Animal Crossing. The couple's friend surprised them by planning a wedding in the game on the same day they were supposed to get married. They streamed the whole thing online.
You don't want to be upstanding? Is that what you do? Do you stand up for the bride?
No, you
can't. We were originally going to get married on the beach, so it was located
this
on the beach.
So cool.
Oh, look at that! Oh. When we first went to the island, there were little tuxedos and shoes and stuff put out that I could put on.
This is so cute. I know, I'm trying like really hard like not to tear up.
There was an arch to walk yeah. through as well, and everyone was sitting down.
They bought a harp.
There was a harp.
Playing a harp.
Someone was playing the harp. The celebrant had like, you know, the hat and like the whole get up.
The officiant delivered their message through the chat in the game.
Today we are gathered to... Are you reading or am I reading?
Celebrate the union of...
It was a quick ceremony. Then the couple typed in their I do's into the game and they were declared.
Mr. and Mrs. Fia! Yeah.
Then at the end, everyone had party poppers that went off after yeah. Kiss the Bride. It was amazing. Yeah, it was so cool.
Some people are using Animal Crossing for other big life events. Karen Morgan lives in Glasgow, Scotland. This past weekend, a family member passed away from COVID-19.
We're not going to be able to have a funeral for Grandad, but I've been working on a little memorial park on my island.
She says working on a memorial park on her island is helping her cope with the whole thing. A few days ago, she went on an online forum for the game and asked if any players had any gravestones. That is an item in the game, but not everyone has it.
And I said, oh, I would love some if anybody has extra.
A woman from the US messaged her saying, I have some, come to my island. Morgan got one for her grandfather and one for her dad, who died back in February. She decorated the memorial with flowers and with in-game items that reminded her of her family. She'll do a real memorial when this is all over, she says. But for now, she's okay mourning in her own little virtual world. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Morgan shared a photo of the memorial garden with us. You can find that on our website, theworld.org, along with a video of the wedding Lydia told us about in her story. Speaking of unions... cellist Yo-Yo Ma has never been able to get the song by Angélique Kidjo out of his head since he heard her sing it a few years ago. It's called Bleu. It's a dirge for the dead. In the West African Ewe language, Bleu is a word that urges calm. These days, like the rest of us, Yo-Yo Ma and Angélique Kidjo have some free time, so they recorded this duet remotely, far apart. We say Bleu to all of you, wishing you calm as you head into the weekend. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH. Stay strong, stay safe, be healthy. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.